I'd like to introduce our first speaker. His name is Dave, and he's from the YDI group of Narcotics Anonymous. I'm Dave, and I'm an addict. I'm going to try to share with you what it was like to find NA and have a period of freedom from active addiction, and then to go back out there again and try to do it on my own. I'm going to try to let you know what happened to me and what it's like now. I started using in the mid-70s, and I tried just about everything and anything. I'd probably be the poster boy for High Times. When I found Narcotics Anonymous, I really didn't have any intent to stay clean. I didn't know that there was another way to live. My whole life was about using drugs, buying drugs, selling drugs, the drug culture. I really wanted detox is what I wanted, and I got to a rehab, and I found that there was a way to stay clean, to have a life without drugs. And I remember getting near the end of that rehab, and my roommate asked me, "Hey Dave," in the middle of the night, we're laying there still awake, and he said, you gonna burn one when you get out of here?" And at that point, I really didn't know. I didn't know. But I was open-minded enough at the time to give it a shot, to try it. And I found Narcotics Anonymous in this area, started going to meetings, made friends. I stayed around for about 4 years. I stayed clean for 4 years. I pretty much just went to meetings and didn't use. I didn't work the steps. I had a sponsor in another fellowship. At that time, that was in the late 80s and early 90s, Narcotics Anonymous wasn't real, real strong where I'm from. I went to both fellowships. I went to AA, I went to NA. I did what I needed to do to stay clean. And you know, life got better. I started to get a career. Things came together. And it was right toward almost the 4 year mark, something happened that made me decide that recovery wasn't first in my life anymore. My dad got cancer, and I decided to stop going to meetings and take care of him. That was really an excuse. Long before that, my recovery started to get boring. You know, I was going to the same meetings, I was doing the same thing, I was hearing the same people. There was a whole lot that I missed. You know, and I'll get to a little bit of that later. But I quit going to meetings. I remember the person that took over my commitment at the home group I was chairing. He said, "Now you're not going to go away, are you? I'll just fill in for you." And I said, yeah, I won't go away. Well, I did. I didn't go back. And it took about 6 months till I relapsed. I used for a month. I quit. I detoxed myself, and I didn't pick up for a while. But the addiction was still there. I channeled it into work and other things. You know, my recovery came to a dead stop. When I look back over those years, you know, the first year was pretty rough, as it is for most of us. And then the next three got better every year. And then when I stopped going to meetings and relapsed, even when I wasn't using for about 2.5 or 3 years, life just went downhill. You know, the self-centeredness came back, the desperation, depression, it all came back, even when I wasn't using. So when I had a minor surgery and they gave me a narcotic pain reliever, it was off to the races. I started dope fiending that doctor from day one. I just got home from him, and was on the phone dope fiending him already. It took about two and a half years from the time that I had that surgery and started using on a daily basis till I finally came to the point of surrender again. When I was out there using, I completely self-willed it. I thought I had everything under control. I tried all the control things we read about in our basic text. I'm only going to stick to one drug. You know, I'm not going to drink, I'm not going to smoke dope, I'm not going to snort coke, I'm just going to stay to this one drug, and I'll be okay, I can control it. And you know, for a very short time I could, but it was a slope. You know, sometimes it was faster, sometimes it was slow, but it was always downhill the whole way. Until it finally came to the point where I couldn't live with or without the drugs. Even when I had the dope, I really felt I was going crazy. My life had become so unmanageable. And being the manipulative addict I was, I hid all this. I hid it from my family. I didn't have any friends left. I'd isolated so badly that although I knew thousands of people from my work and stuff, I didn't have a person I could call a friend. No one that cared about me. Nobody to call and say, you want to go out to dinner? You want to come see a movie? Tell them what's going on in my life. Tell them how bad I was suffering. There was nobody. I hid it from my wife, although she knew I was taking pain medication. She had no idea how bad it had become. I realize now, looking back on this, you know, what I was missing the first time, and this is what kind of, it humbles me and it kind of frightens me, because when I was here those first years, I thought I got it. You know, I thought, you know, I'm staying clean, life's getting good, and I missed so damn much. I missed the fellowship. I missed the we part of this. I missed it, that I couldn't do this by myself, that I needed help. I missed that first step in my heart. You know, I had come in reluctantly, and I think in the back of my mind was that reservation all the time. You know, maybe I can use one. I forgot that it was that first one that started my addiction rolling again. And maybe I had to prove it to myself. You know, there's no shame in relapse. It happens. It's a reality. The shame's not coming back. I felt that when I came back. I had, my self-centeredness had gotten so bad, and I was so arrogant. Even though I'd been using all that time, when I checked into a detox, I could remember feeling like I was better than everybody else. You know, I had all this clean time. I'd been here before. I had it all down pat, and I didn't know crap. I had no idea what was going on. You know, when I got out, well, I'll back up a step. I'll tell you where my surrender really came. I decided to get help, and that came over a trivial thing. It just was the last straw. I ended up crying in my wife's arms for about 4 hours and telling her how bad it really got. And I didn't think I was paranoid, but looking back on it, I took a pocket full of quarters and went to a payphone with a phone book to call, you know, numbers and try to find a detox and a rehab. Now, that's paranoid, even though I, at the time, I didn't realize it. I wouldn't even use my home phone to call an 800 number. I got into a detox, and I remember asking them on the phone if they were equipped to deal with acute opiate withdrawal. Oh, yeah, we deal with this all the time. Well, on my last day of using was on my way to this detox, and I was using very heavily. And they took a picture of me when I first got in there. I looked at it later, and I looked really bad. I didn't think I looked that bad, but I looked really poor. And that night, we had a speaker that was an H&I speaker for a meeting that went in, and it was a drug-a-log, pretty much. And I remember sitting there starting to get sick, and I was starting to sweat on the left half of my body. And I went to bed, lights off, and I woke up in the middle of the night deathly sick. And, you know, well, I'm just going to be sick. I was confined to that. And the nurses came in and checked me, and they went running for clonidine patches and stuff to stick under my tongue. And they said, why didn't you tell us you were so sick? And I'm like, duh. You know, didn't you expect that? And the next thing I remember is waking up and looking up at this doctor. He was a funny looking guy. He reminds me of the Simpsons neighbor with the walrus mustache. And he had a tweed vest on, you know, sweater vest-like. And he's looking down over me like this. And he said, well, David, we look pretty bad. And I said, he said, how do you feel? And I said, like shit. And he said, you look like it. He said, we better detox you on methadone, I think. And there was a second there, laying in that bed, I was so sick, and I knew what was ahead of me. And that was inviting, to know that some of that pain was going to be, that physical pain was going to be relieved. And that was the moment of surrender for me. I said, no. I said, just keep me alive for the next 3 days. I'm done. I'm done. And the relief was so palpable. The weight that came off my shoulders at that minute, even though I was so sick. I knew I had to eat. I remember my roommate took care of me for 3 days. I barely remember, but he'd come in and sit me up and put a tray in front of me, and I would, with my eyes closed, just eat anything that was on the tray. And I just wanted to get well again. I stayed there for 10 days. And when I left, I had no idea if NA even existed out here anymore. It had been 7 years since I'd been to the meeting. I had an outdated meeting list. The times were all wrong. Some of the locations were wrong. The first night I was home, I went with my wife. I was real excited. It was just, it's almost indescribable, the relief of knowing that I lived through it and that I was on my way back. I found a meeting in a town about 30 miles from me and sat in on it. I remember telling them I was 23 hours out of a rehab, I was ashamed. I didn't know what to expect. I knew, you know, from my previous experience, that we welcome back people that relapse because it happens, and the courage it takes to come back in there is something we really respect. The courage it takes to come back after what a lot of people consider a failure. I felt that, and I was hugged, and I was welcomed, and I kept coming back. This time, that nuclear blast, I think, that is mentioned in our basic text in that recovery, or that book, that chapter, Recovery and Relapse, happened to me. And I was a little more willing to do what I was told this time. Yeah, I still put up a little bit of a struggle. I remember my sponsor asking me if I got phone numbers yet. And I said, well, no. Yeah, it was after a couple of weeks. And he said, well, why not? And I said, well, I'm getting some time to get to know me a little bit, and I'll get to know people. And he said, David, there's not a person in this room that's not going to give you a phone number if you ask them. So I screwed up my courage, and he was right. Everybody gave me phone numbers. And those people, most of those people who are still around now, are a very important part of my support group. I remember hearing about the steps, and I knew I didn't work them before. I was of a different mindset this time, but I remember telling my sponsor, do I have to actually write them down? I mean, can't we just talk about these things, you know, and that's good enough? Because that's what I did before. And he said something that was a little different. He said, Dave, if you don't know how to write, or you can't write, we'll work something else out. We'll get a tape recorder, we'll do something, but it's got to be a permanent record. We've got to get it down. And he explained to me how writing those steps down does a couple things for me. One, it slows my thoughts down, makes me think about what I'm actually feeling, and gets it deeper and ingrains it in my head just by putting it on paper. And for another thing, it makes that permanent record. Do it in ink, he said. Don't do it in pencil. You're not going to go back and change nothing. You know, this is going to come out. The thing, I think, the biggest thing I got this time that I missed last time is the fellowship. You know, the program is the steps to me. That's the program of Narcotics Anonymous. That's that change that has to take place in my life, not only for me to stay clean, but for me to enjoy life, to live life, to live a life worth living for a change. The fellowship's all this other stuff. What we're doing right now, our meetings, you know, our literature, our get-togethers, the telephone calls, the coffee after the meetings, all that. That's what I missed. I didn't realize the first time that I could not do this alone. And I know I can't now. And to get these relationships I need with other men, I have to go out and fellowship. I have to go out and meet people and talk to people. And I have to be honest and share what's going on in my head and in my heart. And I know everybody here has something that can help me today. The difference is, you know, it was like I was on a pink cloud when I came out of that second detox. It hasn't gone away. You know, it's not a pink cloud. My life has changed so much in the last 2.5 years. It's almost hard to describe. It's gone the complete opposite from that feeling of desperation, that lost feeling, the darkness, the depression, the hopelessness. I remember the night that I told my wife. I remember the tiny thing that did it. My mother had fallen and broken her arm. She's going to be 80 pretty soon. She was, about 76 then, I guess, going to be 77. She had fallen and broken her arm, and she had worked all her life in this family business and didn't have any fellowshipping with anybody. So here she was. Now she can't work, which is what I was doing before. I was pouring all myself into work when I wasn't using. She's wringing her hand. She doesn't know what to do with herself. She doesn't have any friends. And I went home that night and sat down on my deck and thought, that's all you have to look forward to, David. When you're in your 70s, that's all there is anymore. You're not going to have any friends. This is going to be like this. And I just started to cry. The hopelessness was so bad. I knew I was at the end. And this wasn't withdrawal or detox or anything. I had pocket full of drugs. This was just the end of the road for me. And my wife was shocked, absolutely shocked. And I still didn't tell her how bad it was until she came to visit me at that detox center, that rehab. And then she was really shocked because the quantity of dope I was taking had escalated so much that it's a wonder I'm here. The Tylenol alone that I was eating every day should have caused my liver to fail, and it didn't. And that's part of the grace I've gotten in this program. You know, God did that for me. My higher power kept me alive that long and got me back here. For that, I'm really grateful. So, you know, recovery or relapse does happen. You know, and when it does, to get back, it's double grace. it doesn't have to be the end of the world. If it kills us, you know, that's the other alternative. A lot of us can make it into rehabs or into jails, and we can survive if we relapse. But the key is to keep coming back even after a relapse. Thanks for listening.
Thanks, Steve. I'd like to introduce our second speaker, Carol, and your home group is Atmosphere of Recovery.
Woo! Aloha, family. My name is Carol. I'm an addict. And I'm a nervous addict. I did a lot of praying today before I got up here, and I prayed that my higher power speaks through me, you know, so that you can hear something from him. And I'm just going to start out with a little experience, strength, and hope. I first got clean August 15th, 1977. I was 17 years old, and I went into... they didn't have detoxes back in 77. They had mental institutions. And so I was up there for a while. I don't know exactly how long. I know it was more than a month. I didn't know I was going to a mental institution until I got up there and the door slammed behind me. It locked. And I looked and I'm like, what's this? You know, and then another door locked. And then they said, you're going to stay over here for 10 days. We're going to evaluate you. And everybody was in straitjackets and drooling, and, you know, they were crazy people. And I was like, oh, man, I can't stay here, you know. And I stayed. They said only 10 days. And I had to detox, go through withdrawals with crazy people. And I came back to my room one night, and my roommate was dressed in my clothes, sitting on my bed, with all my pictures and my personal belongings, pretending to be me. And I flipped out. And the next thing you know, they put a straitjacket on me and gave me a shot. But when I woke up, they had put me on the other side. And I was very grateful for that. And, you know, the way they detoxed me was just to put me on, you know, Tylenols and Secinols and Placidils. And, you know, it just traded one drug for another, you know, and I was 17 and I didn't know it, and but it got me through what I got through. And when I got out, it was my third day of my senior year of high school, and I went to school and talked to the counselor, and she was like, where were you last year? You know, I said, well, you know, I got real sick, I got caught up, you know, into drugs and stuff. And she gave me a name of a intervention counselor with a treatment center. And I went home and called him, and I went and met him. And next thing I knew, I was signing my life away for 2 years. I went into a 2-year treatment center with 70 other addicts. And 99% of them were there from prison. They were shortening like a 10-year sentence. If they did a 2-year program, they shortened it to 5. I was the only one there who was there on my own. And, you know, and I had all these old men and these old junkies telling me, you know, just telling me I wasn't an addict. And I stayed there for 2 years. I stayed clean. You know, I got some skills that I didn't have growing up in Chicago. Basically, I stayed clean for 5 years. And when I was 22, life was so good from not using. My life was totally changed around. I had a job. I had my own apartment. I had friends. You know, I was in school. And life got real good. And I stopped going to meetings. And I figured I was 22. I wanted to hang around people my age. And where did people who were 22 hang out? They hung out in bars. You know, And I started getting angry at my higher power, saying, you know, how come they get to go have fun and I don't? So I went and got a job as a bartender. That was a mistake. I relapsed within a month. And But I didn't look at it as a relapse because I wasn't shooting dope and I wasn't drinking whiskey and I wasn't eating Placidils and Tylenols and Tecanols. I was just drinking wine and I was just, you know, doing a little crank and some coke. So my disease told me that I wasn't relapsing, that this was okay. I'm serious. I'm telling you, man, I was just partying. I wasn't relapsing. And that lasted about a year. And some yucks happened to me during that year. And in 1984, I got clean again. I got married. I got married down in Texas. We moved up to Pennsylvania. I lived in Pittsburgh for 10 years. I have 3 kids. When I got married, you know, my husband and I made vows that we would stop using, we wouldn't use anything. And I didn't. So for 10 years I stayed abstinent. I wasn't clean because I was not allowed to go to meetings. My ex-husband now, he's my ex-husband, wouldn't allow me to go to meetings because how it would make him look in his business. You know, how it would financially affect him. And I can remember telling him, why don't we just go back to meetings? I was so happy when I went to meetings. You know, I had a life, you know, but he wouldn't allow it. And I was miserable. Yeah, I was abstinent for 10 years. I was miserable. I had a t-shirt that said, if mama ain't happy, ain't nobody happy. And that's how it was. No one in my life around me was happy because I was miserable and I was going to make all you miserable. And I had a reservation, and the only reason why I know that it was a big, huge reservation, you know that guy on Sanford and Son, you know where he's having that heart attack? You know, like, this is the big one, this is it? I had mine, and mine was when I found out my husband was cheating on me. I couldn't handle it, and I used that reservation to go out, and I made a conscious decision, and I said it. I'm going out, and I'm going to party, and I'm going to do what I want, and if it kills me, it kills me. Then I die. So this was in 92. I made a conscious decision to start going out and party, and I had a live-in nanny live with me. She took care of the kids. I had, you know, a bottomless checking account. I had money. I lost a lot of weight after having the 3 kids, and I just went out, and I was just going to drink champagne, and I was just going to do the best coke, but only a little bit. And I was just going to start out with like 1 little gram and just do a line on Friday night or something. I mean, that's the disease lying to me, you know? And I believed the lie. I did. I believed the lie. And I thought that I could control it. And within 30 days, I thought I was smoking coke, but I was smoking crack. And I didn't know that that's what I was doing. And I tell you what, I had a lot of back surgeries too. I had a lot of back pain, and I always had a bottle of 90 Vicodins, a bottle of 90 Xanax. I mean, I had a drugstore in my purse, and I played doctor for so long, and I was full of rage and anger. And I vented it on everybody around me, same as I did when I was abstinent. But now here I'm using, and I was a danger to myself. You know, I was reacting to cops, I was reacting to anybody, and I was a danger to myself. And I got to the point where I knew that I was going to die, but I wanted to prove to myself that I could drink alcohol. So I didn't drink for a whole week. And I don't remember if I did any drugs or not, but I know I didn't drink. And I remember meeting my friend at the bar. I hung out in all these titty bars. Sorry. it was just insane. I acted out all of my yes yet. And I did that during a year and a half of my last relapse in this fight. I felt so shameful, and I mean, where it took me and the places it took me. I was no longer hanging out at the country club, you know what I mean? I was hanging out at, you know, the Edison and, you know, all these different places that, you know, a mother doesn't belong, you know? And I remember one night I wanted to die, you know, and I just put one big last hit on the pipe and I just said, God, please take my life now. I can't live like this anymore. And I took the hit and I fell off my chair and I started to see that tunnel. I don't know if anybody's ever seen it, but it's like a white light and then all of a sudden it turns black. For 5 hours I was blind. But as soon as that happened, because I said, God, please take my life. I can't live like this anymore. As soon as he was taking my life, I said this out loud. I said, I changed my mind. I want to live. Please let me live. And he let me lay there on the kitchen floor for 5 hours. I could hear, you know, and I could barely move, but I couldn't see. And my heart was like pounding out of my chest. I had bullet size, the sweat was the size of bullets coming out of me. And I was dying, and I did the first step, you know, because I had been in this program before. I'm telling you, you know, to have a head full of NA and know what works and then to be out there, man, it sucks. You know, I remember sitting at a bar and talking about, yeah, how one day maybe, you know, I met someone else who was also in the program, and we're both sitting at the bar talking about it, you know, and getting high and doing this. And I said, you know, one day if we both make it back, you know, that would be pretty cool. But both of us couldn't make it back. And you know what? He's dead. He's dead, you know. And there's a lot of people I saw die. And I almost did. I almost didn't make it back. But for the grace of God, here I am. And I don't know why I was given the grace to be here. But you know what? Sometimes, actually, I do know why now. I've been coming around here. I'm coming up on 10 years again. And it's been a journey. And I think the reason why he gave me that grace was so that I can come here and open up my mouth and share my experience, strength, and hope, so that maybe you don't have to go through what I went through. And I'll tell you what messed me up both times when I relapsed was relationships. The first time, you know, I had gotten involved with somebody and he relapsed, and I was like, you know, I'll show him I'll relapse too, you know. And the second time was a relationship also. And now over the last 9 years, I've been in and out of a few relationships, and I've been very close to relapsing. But it's not necessarily picking up the drugs and relapsing. If I relapse now on my character defects, I still have that FU attitude. And I look at it as an emotional relapse. I have those here. And you know what? As long as I don't pick up and use over it, and I walk through it and I let you guys love me through it, I learn from that, you know. And I still suffer with low self-esteem and self-pity. Those are my character defects. They seep in on me, you know, when I'm least expecting it. And I just moved back from Hawaii. I was blessed to be able to live there for 7 years in recovery. Now, you talk about a gift. You know, here I am smoking crack in Pittsburgh, and then I get clean, and I get to go live in Hawaii, you know, and it was just awesome. It was just awesome. And, you know, I got a lot of aloha there, and I got a lot of love. And before I left the island, they told me, they said, Carol, you have so much aloha, you need to give that to the people back there on the mainland. You need to let them know, you know, what it's all about. And I've been back a little bit over a year, and I haven't felt qualified. I haven't felt worthy. I haven't felt like I had anything to give you guys, you know. So I really haven't opened my mouth, you know. And I got into a relationship when I got here, and I was full of shame, you know. I was embarrassed. I was embarrassed for being human, you know what I mean? I think that's called ego. I think that's called ego and pride, you know. And I'm learning in here that I can pick up my head, you know, and say, yeah, I'm human, I made a mistake. Let's talk about it and help me get through this. And that's what I've learned to do here. And I've also learned boundaries. That's been my hardest thing, too. I've always been a people pleaser to the point where I lose me, you know. And then who suffers in the end? Me, And there's one other thing I want to talk about, and that is a level of honesty. Honesty is being honest 100%. I always thought that if I was not going to be honest with someone 100%, I was just going to try to change the truth a little, not to hurt them. But in the end, not telling the truth 100% has come back to bite me, and I'm the one who has been hurt. So I realized I need to learn to be honest with you guys, even if it might hurt you. Maybe that's what it's supposed to be, but I need to be honest. And that's been another hard lesson for me. Being honest with compassion and truly genuinely loving another person. You know, I love every single one of you in here, but there's some of you I absolutely do not like. And that is okay. It's okay. Not everybody in here is going to like you. Not everybody in here is going to be your friend. But I've learned the relationships I have with people on the outside, I've learned to have relationships with you guys in here so that I can go out there and have relationships with people. Anyways, I'm still nervous, but I feel better. Got it all out there. And I'm I can go to sleep tonight, wake up in the morning and wake up with the worst attitude, and I can pick up again because it's just a choice to pick up. You know, but I have to keep in the back of my mind where I came from and where I will go just that quick. It took me 30 days last time. I think it would take me one shot next time. I would be so full of shame and guilt, and I would just like take the whole thing and just do it all, get it over with, you know. But you guys are my family. I don't have a relationship with my family like I have with you guys. You know, that's why I say aloha family, you know, because you guys are my family, and I know you'll love me. And I'm a shy person sometimes. People who know me will probably say, no, you're not. But I'm shy, and but you guys are loving me, and I want to thank you for showing up. This is my first Unity retreat, and I plan on coming back. This is the most peaceful and close I've been to feeling like I'm in Hawaii. This is it. You know, if no one's ever been there, this is Hawaii right here. This is exactly what it is. You know, I love you. Thanks.
There's still time if anybody'd like to share.
My name's Dan, and I'm an addict.
Hey, Dan.
You know, what I heard from both these people, you know, is my experience, too. And what I come to find out, man, is, like, just like recovery is a process, so is, like, relapse. And, you know, the lady just shared, she talked about, like, relationships and, you know, how they can put us back out on the corner. And that's my experience, too, you know. I had some time in this fellowship. I'm not going to get into how long I was here because that isn't important. It's about important about today. And I did things, and it was good. My life got good. Like my man said, you know, I got a union job, and I got a new ride, and I got a portfolio, and all that jazz, and I thought like that stuff was going to fix me. You know, I thought like social acceptability was like going to fix me, I got opportunities to take new job experiences, and what happened was I got into a relationship and it started going south, and I didn't go to meetings for a while, I didn't read the literature for a while, and you know, in a matter of probably about 2 months, you know, I was back to numbing myself again. In here, out there, and you know, it took me like a whole year to come back, man. And it was one of the hardest processes I ever did. And you know, I need to share that today with you people. And I'm still struggling, you know. I really like what both speakers had to say, you know. I know today I got to keep the focus on me like 100%, man, and it's a Just for Today program. And the guy that was sharing at the Triangle of Self-Obsession said this is like an uphill thing. Like, I can't, the only way I'm going to coast is backwards. And I found that out the hard way. You know, I can't, like, start blowing off my meetings and my home group and, you know, I'm not doing that stuff, you know, today because I'll end up using it again. Somebody just shared with me, you know, the same person will use again. And when you have time in this fellowship and you go back out, and this is just for me, I had to sit down and, like, look at what I didn't do. You know, there was things, I had to take an inventory. There was good things I did, and there was bad things I did. And, you know, one thing was, you know, I had time in this fellowship, and I didn't have a God of my understanding. And today I'm working on that process with somebody outside this fellowship, somebody that is more experienced in that field than I am. You know what I mean? And that's like, for me, I never had no humility. And that's like, you know, can you help me? I don't understand this today. You know, you know, I wasn't humble at all, man. And today, you know, I'm just blessed to have that. I remember sitting here for my first 90 days clean, and every time you guys say clean time, I had to go to the bathroom, you know. I couldn't share unless I felt like Hughes was the only time I shared, man, because I felt so bad inside. You know, I knew that Hughes would give me a gift, and I just threw it away. You know, Hughes didn't want nothing from me, and I just, like, threw that away. And I'm just so blessed to be here today, man. You know, stuff like this gave me. You know, I know Bobby, and I know a lot of people up here, man, and I'm just so glad to be back because I don't want to die out there, you know. And like the lady said, you know, I know I need to love everybody in here, but a lot of people I have to love from a distance because I can't have you like crazy in my life today. You know, because right away that'll get the folk. I can, like, get into the gossip thing. I can get into taking everybody's inventory in here and get right off my square, man, and be right back on the corner. And what I found out, this is a program of, like, examining myself and helping others. And for years I wanted to examine you and help myself. You know, and nobody told you I loved you. Anybody loved you today, I'd be back.
Anybody else would like to share?
I'm an addict named Joe.
Yeah.
Read out from recovery. I just need to say, like, I've relapsed a whole lot of times in this program. I've been trying to get this program for 9 years, and I've never got over 90 days. You know, and right now I'm in the process of going to 13th, having 6 months. So, like, I don't know, like, when the button was pushed or whatever to get me over that 90 days. But I know some things I try to do different today. You know, and like, a couple people, a guy had told me what to do up in Lancaster. And I never realized that I stopped doing it until I got up here. You know, he was cheering with me. He said, Joe, you know, the only reason you're still coming is you're not washing them cars. See, because the relapse to me, I used to do the dope man's car, a whole lot of dope man's car. And they would hand me money or crack. And I would always go for the crack. You know, and the only reason I got this little bit of time today, you know, it's coming up on 6 months, is because I stopped washing their cars. You know, I didn't make a real major, that don't really seem like a major change to me, but you know what? Something's happening, you know what I mean? And like, I go to meetings every day, and like, when I came back, I got a sponsor, man, who's lovely. I'm telling you, man, you know, I called him. He said, oh, you tired, huh? I said, yeah, we got back in the groove of things. And, like, he hangs with some people. It's, like, right on time, man. They, like, adopted me, man. You know what I mean? They take me out. We go here to eat after the meeting. We get together before the meeting. And, like, that's one of the things that's really helping me this time. You know what I mean? I just don't want to go back to that pain, man. You know? And I think that's what probably made me make the decision not to do the car. I don't even wash my own car. Seriously. I've been clean. So now I got about $5 in my pocket every week. I take it down to the House of the Crossroads and let them do it. You know what I mean? And, like, that's, like, change for me. Because, like, all my life I've been, like, what you call a hustler. I like to make money. But I would make it and just give it away, man. And today I'm, like, real content. You know, I can have, like, a few dollars in my pocket and I'm not going crazy. You know? But, like, this is my second time up here. The first time I came up was a couple years ago. I just came for, like, a day. You know, my sponsor and them said they was coming, so I got my money together. And, like, I'm really having a good time, right? I'm a city boy. I ain't really used to all these weeds and them strange sounds at night and shit. But it's not as strange as, like, I mean, it's not as scary as, like, in the city when you're walking down the street and you're hearing gunfire. You know what I mean? The crickets sound better than the gunfire right now. Thanks for letting me share.
Yeah, we still got time.
I'm an Anthony Wendy. Hey, family. There's a couple of things I just wanted to add. Everybody was excellent. And, somebody asked me how much time I have now. I always preference by this time. Because I did relapse. And I was using, and when I came back in, they always say, you know, our disease is progressive while we're staying clean. So when I came back in, there's still no treatment facilities. There was somebody there with a trash can and a baggie and chocolate and sugar water, and we all took turns, you know, around the clock. The man always had a 4-hour shift to make sure we'd make it through the night. And I found out when we first started, back in 53, the chances of one addict out of 36 was to get clean. It's still the same today. And I got a second chance. And a lot of us get a second chance. And some people, they don't make it back. I want to point out in my basic text, it does not say relapse and recovery. It says recovery and relapse. And by God's grace, I know there's a research team out there, and they're doing all the relapsing for me, and none of them have come back and told me how great it was. As a matter of fact, I understand, I probably couldn't afford to use today. I'd have to do a whole lot more stealing now than I did then. And none of them's come back and told me things are any better. There's some new stuff out there, but it does the same old stuff, you know. And I found out while I was out there, what set me back out was I stopped working step one. I was no longer powerless. I was going to fix it. Sorry, God, you're too slow. Get the heck out of the way. And the last one is I will get it done. Not our will. And so that eliminates step one, two, and three, right? Got rid of those guys real quick. I decided to work my full-time job and another job, so that did not leave time for meetings, and did not leave time for balance, did not leave time for basic things that I still have to do today. And it tells me, you know, when I work step 10, I can stop bringing on all my crap in a real short time before I do it. So basically, I just said, hasta la vista, steps, so long, people, and went out there and tried to do it on my own. And I love what my sponsor taught me. When I came back in the last time, she said, write down everything you learned why you had that relapse. And I did. And then she said, well, since you learned something from it, it wasn't a waste of time. And today there's still times when I sit there and I go, to my people that I sponsored, did you learn something from that? No matter what it is, whether it's clean time, whether it's a step, what did you learn? And it has to be written. A little bitchy if you don't write it. It must. It was one of us as folks, you know, when you write, it ends up on paper what you don't really, you know, get or what you want to be in denial about. And I have even had them write on a grocery bag, you know, oh, wait, you guys are in plastic era. This is back when we had paper bags. They've written it on, you know, brown trash bags. They've written it in the dirt and saying, I don't care. It's got to be written. I don't care where you write it. I don't care if it's in fire ashes. You've got to write it. Because there's something when we write that all of a sudden appears that we didn't know it was there before. You know, it just comes out when you're writing, and it's really neat. And for those of you that don't have a sponsor, well, that's okay. But it, you know, for those of you who don't work the steps, don't. For those of you who don't have a sponsor, don't. For those of you who don't come to meetings very often, don't. As long as you can stand the pain. And I don't have to do that anymore. And I'm real grateful for this fellowship. I'm grateful I made it back. And I hope you all use your first chance and never have to use your second. Love you all. Thank you.
Rico and I'm an addict. I, like Danny, too, have spent some time in this fellowship, and I want to start off, like, when I first got here, like, I had made a list of things that I wanted to do when I got here, you know, and I had accomplished those things when I was here. You know, like, the lady was sharing earlier about, like, people pleasing, like, I have one of those, I'm like one of those people. You know, the reason why, like, I had made that list of things I needed is because, like I wanted to accomplish some things for me that I had never done in my life. Like, I grew up, and I didn't really have nothing growing up. And when I got here, like, I decided I wanted some things in my life. You know, I probably, like most people, and I'm going to share this because I think, like, there's probably somebody here that needs to hear it, is that I was, like, just real empty and real lost growing up as a kid. And some things happened throughout my life that, you know, left me feeling like that. And when I got in here, you know, I had looked at some people that had some time in here, and they had some things in their life, you know, and they looked like they were okay. And, like, so, like, I made that list of things that I wanted to do. And I did those. You know, and those things weren't important. They're not important now. But what happened was to me is, like, I had fixed out the outside of me. I really did. Like, I come in here, or I had, like, 6 months of recovery. I had, like, bought a car one time. And on the way home, like, the next day, like, the car broke from work. The axle broke on the car. So after I got the axle fixed that day, I went and, like, bought some pearl wax and some, like, Armor All. And, like I dressed up this car, and I went to the meeting, and somebody had said to me, boy, the car looks good, but is it running any better? And so it really wasn't, because it was still shaking, and, you know, it just wasn't. That's like what happened to me in this fellowship, is that I came in here and, I got some letters behind my name, and I bought a couple houses, and I got some cars, and I had some money, and I had some custody of my little girl, and I had stopped coming to meetings because, like, I don't know in the back of my head that I feel like I had arrived here, you know, but I had the relationship, and I had those things in my life, and I stopped coming to meetings, and I stopped talking to people that, like, I got to know, and I thought that I had got to love. And at the end of this using part of my life, after I had relapsed, you know, I decided, you know, my friend Danny came and got to me. I was working out in Baltimore. He came and got me and brought me back home on the 3rd of July. And I had used that morning. And I came back. He would come back and pick me up. He came and got me on the 3rd and came back here and we spent like the 4th of July together and we did some meetings and stuff. And I went back and I spent 2 or 3 more weeks up in Baltimore working, trying to like stay clean while people I was all around were using. This is the whole point. I made a decision. I was talking to my sponsor and people about like I was making $1,000 a week up there, so like I needed to keep my job, you know, my sponsor. And I, every week I come home on Friday and I just like stay with Danny, and I go back on Sunday. I talked to my sponsor for those couple weeks that I was coming back around here, and I said, and people would tell me like the money's not everything, so I take a risk on like quitting this job and coming back, and I did that. And then my whole point to this is that Friday when I got dropped off. Exactly 3 weeks ago yesterday, I got dropped off on the turnpike, and I had all these bags, you know, I had all my stuff. It wasn't very much, you know, Timmy calls it my house, but because it was, and I had all my bags, like I'm on New Stanton, right there, right before the New Stanton exit, like there's a McDonald's there, and I carried all my bags, like across the highway over to Medium on the turnpike, which you're like not allowed to do. I didn't like know that, so they shared it with me. But like I'm sitting there, I got all my stuff obsessed, and I put all my stuff like real neat in the, you know, in the parking lot. And I just had sat down, I had a crate full of tools, and I sat down on my crate, and I heard this voice behind me, and the voice said, "Can I help you?" You know, and I turned around and I said, "No, I'm okay. You know, I'm waiting on my ride." I said, "No, I'm okay." You know, and she said, "Well, what are you doing in our parking lot with like all your stuff?" And I said, "Well, like, I'm waiting on a ride. Like, I just got dropped off." And she goes, "Oh." She goes, "Well, we didn't, like, want you to get hit." And I thought, well, like, you seen me from, like, must have been in the store and the McDonald's. Like, everybody else would just see me sitting here. And she goes, "Well, we know, I was just concerned. We didn't want you to get hit." And she turned, and I said, "Oh, okay. Well, I'm just waiting on my ride." And she turned around and walked away. And I wanted to turn around and I wanted to yell at her, like, "I'm not a bum." You know, like, I got $1,000. I got $1,000 in my pocket. Like, these are tools that are worth like $1,000. Like, I wanted to yell that, but she was already gone. And what I thought about was like, but I am a bum. I'm a couple days clean. I'm staying at my sponsor's house, and I ain't got a car. This is all I got. Like, and I sat down, and there was this like ant hill, and I shared with Danny, like, I want to crawl in it with him. Because you know what? It's what I did for 6 years in this fellowship. I had dressed up the outside. I wanted to, like, define myself with things I had. And I was still just really empty and lost in the inside of me. And no longer do I, like, want to, like, come here and, like, I got a list today of what I want to do. And it has nothing to do with school and work and money and jobs and women. It has nothing to do with any of that in my life today. It's about, like, I just want to be, like, okay with Rico. Because you know what? Like, I know when that lady said to me, "Can I help you?" If I'd have been okay with me, I would have turned around and said to her, "No, I'm all right. I'm waiting on a ride." And no matter what she thought in her mind, because like when she left, I like looked at myself. I had work jeans on that were dirty, a 3X t-shirt because it was the only one I had left clean, hair windblown, you know, it wasn't cut short. I looked like I felt. And she and when I turned around and I said to her, like, "No, I'm all right." If I'd have been okay, like, with me, like, whatever she thought after that would have been okay, but, like, I thought I had to defend myself again with, like, the things that I had got when I got here. You know, I'm going to share this and I'm going to shut up. I love Danny. I love you so much. I was at a meeting, and a female had walked up to me, and I have this, like, problem, like, and I don't know why, but I have this problem of, like, I need people, please, and, like, the lady was, I need people to, like, be okay with me, and that makes me okay. I was at a meeting, and this girl had walked up to me, and a couple days clean I got, you know, and I wanted to talk to this other guy, and this girl had, like, stepped between us, and she started talking to me, and Danny comes up to me, and he hugs me, and he said, "What are you doing?" And he turns around, and he looks at the girl, and he said to the girl, "You know, you need to leave him alone because, like, his life depends on it today. You know, because I don't know how to do that stuff. You know, and I'm glad I got people like Danny in my life who, like, love me enough to care about those things. But, like, if anything out of this message is about, like, for me, like, I want to be, like, okay with Rico for the first time in my life. Because the 6 years I spent in this fellowship and the love that I have for my, look, I remember holding my little girl with 2 years old, and she's like begging for her mom, is she ever coming back? And I couldn't answer her. And I said to her, but she said to me, Daddy, are you going to go anywhere? And I remember saying to her, Daddy, I'm always going to be here. Daddy's not going anywhere. And when I used, I went away. I went away. I left her, and I went away. And you know what? There's nothing else in this world that's going to keep me clean. And it's a shame that I had to go through and lose everything and lose my little girl to, like, believe that today. But, like, none of that. The love I have for that little girl will never keep me clean. Never. The money in my pocket, the things that I have will never keep me clean. It's the love of, like, Danny, who came to Baltimore to pick up an addict struggling, you know, who came all the way to Baltimore to bring me home for the 4th and take me back on Sunday. You know, I love you for that because you, like, saved my life. Thanks.
Hi, my name's Julia, and I'm an addict. I just have an announcement. There is a woman's meeting at 9:45 in the Harmony Cabin. So if you're going to be here, please join us.
Anybody else? All right, I'd like to thank the speakers for sharing their experience, strength, and hope with us. Can we have the Just for Today reading from the podium?
Just for today.
All right, we have a nice way of closing. Can we form a circle and close with the we version of the Serenity Prayer?